From RTE Radio, I'm Neil O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
You end up going to Sweden, and I mentioned that it was love that made you stay.
This is a bit of a tongue twister, but how many sheep can a sheep shearer shear in one day?
She was way out of my league, but I just gave it a go, and I asked her on a date.
Coming up on this sunny Melange edition of Playback Daily, love in a cold climate, the cello virtuoso living in the Arctic Circle. You can't handle the truth. All the buzz from Shearfest 2025. And finally revealed, the woman who inspired the song After All. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that might inspire a love song someday. Let's begin today with the Oliver Callan Morning Monologue, and Dermot Whelan, sitting in for Oliver again today, riffing on an article from The Sun about dads and their hilarious ways, as we all count down to Father's Day this Sunday, isn't it? Anyway, here's some of Dermot's selections.
Google Maps doesn't exist for dads. Let me tell you the directions in depth. You know the road down there with the yellow house? Yeah, don't go down there. Counting the cars that make it through traffic lights. I am definitely guilty of that one. I mean, I'm a pretty calm person a lot of the time, but when the lights change and nobody moves, I'm like a ranting fool at the steering wheel. Particularly when it rains and people lose the ability to drive around a corner. Is it just me or is it a dad thing? And obsession with closing the door to any room with even a whisper of a nearby draft. If you ask my kids, they will tell you that I am obsessed. And the thing that annoys me the most is when they come down, like wearing a pair of boxer shorts and a t-shirt, going, the house is freezing and all the doors are open. And you do say dad things like, well, shut the bloody door then. Some of the top 30 favourites in the paper, telling bad or corny jokes, telling the same story multiple times. I think that's our God-given right. Do you remember the time when we went on holiday? Having a favourite chair that no one else is allowed to sit in. Check. Dad dancing. I think I'm more about embarrassing dad singing. That's what really gets to my kids when I just start singing with no shame. It will literally crush a teenager when you do it in front of them. Complaining about what you're watching on TV, but then sitting down to watch it anyway. Yes, I am now a man who is a full expert on Gilmore Girls from doing that exact thing. Fascinating show. Starting conversation with strangers. Yep. Sending the thumbs up emoji, or any emoji, incidentally. I didn't realise until recently that if you use emojis, your children will think you're particularly sad, just if you use them at all. And the thumb one, definitely a dad one. Making jokes to waiters. Why wouldn't we? We're hilarious. And the lawn thing, I have to say, is absolutely true for me. I'm noticing as I get older, I'm becoming more obsessed with mowing the lawn. And I find myself looking out the window, longing for it to grow so that I can get out and cut it again to get that feeling of I've just cut the grass, you know, where you come back into the house after it and you're like desperately hoping my wife would say, God, it looks great out there. I know. I just cut the grass. All 6 square feet of it. Literally this morning, I saw it rained overnight and I thought, great, a good growth spurt now and I can get back out there, put manners on that grass. I think in some ways, a manicured lawn is for me what a tidy kitchen is for my wife. I mean, everything just seems a little easier, doesn't it, when it's all in order? There may be strands of my life that are spinning out in a chaotic swirl, but the grass looks great, and that is a solid foundation. And if I take a strimmer to the edges, watch out, I'm actually dangerous. Throw anything at me, I can take it. I also every morning like to say a quick prayer to the patron saint of grass, rugby's St. Peter O'Mahony, in the name of the fertiliser, the lawn and the holy strimmer. Amen. Certain other dadisms have been creeping into complaining about a stiff neck and shoulders. That's one. Clearing my throat a lot. You know, as a man, you turn 45 and suddenly you start making this noise. I know you're doing it. It also begs the question, at what age do you suddenly become a great whistler? And we've all heard those older painter decorator types that can whistle in a beautiful vibrato, usually to a completely unrecognisable tune. You know, that's those lads up ladders that go. I think it just comes to us as we get older. Falling asleep with your mouth gaping open. I can't believe I'm actually doing that these days. I mean, I know this because my kids pointed out to me. I remember coming home from school and regularly finding my mother catching flies with a gawping mouth as she passed out yet again in the middle of an episode of Live at Three. In fairness, you can't blame her. That show was an effective sedative. I thought, how sad. You can't even stay awake during a segment on The Perfect Scone.
Sleep shaming his own mother during a piece on dadisms. The Aren't Dads Hilarious listicle continued with a detour into health and ageing that includes mums.
The involuntary noise we make getting in and out of chairs. You know the classic, suppose I'd better put the dinner on. You know that one. But if you find yourself making this classic groan, getting up or down in and out of the car, be warned. I was chatting to Dr. Mark Rowe recently, author of Things Your Future Self Will Thank You For, and was a guest on this show before. And he says that one of the markers for life longevity is how quickly you get up from a seated position. There's a study in the British Medical Journal. It found robust associations between chair rise speed and all-cause mortality rates over 13 years of follow-up. So there were two other tests as well mentioned in that study, grip strength and an ability to balance on one leg for a prolonged length of time. So if you want to feel less like an owl fella or an owl one today and live longer, make sure you spend most of today leaping out of chairs onto one leg while squeezing the life out of something or someone. You're more likely to be here in 13 years' time. You're welcome.
We're really not worthy. But there's more.
We just heard on the on Morning Ireland there about the sad death of author Frederick Forsyth. And you know, I was thinking Frederick Forsyth was one of those names you saw in every Irish home. He was just one of those staples that as a kid you saw looking down at you from the bookshelf. I wonder, was it the same in your house? There were other names too that I remember. Leon Uris was one. Maeve Binchy, Geoffrey Archer. Never read any of them, but then they became like familiar friends sitting there. I did watch Day of the Jackal though on Netflix recently with Eddie Redmayne, and that was excellent. And I love the way secret agents in these stories always have a secret room in the house that is home to all their hidden weapons and equipment. And I'd really love one of those. I was thinking all parents should have one of those rooms for your special items. You know, you just say to the kids, I'm just nipping upstairs to change my shoes. And then you press a button in your sock drawer and then and the wall slides back, and inside you have all the things you can't leave out after you have children. Your record player that they can't wait to break the needle off. Your posh chocolate. Fancy makeup you've hidden from your teenage daughters. Cool clothes you don't want them to borrow and destroy. Designer furniture with sharp corners. Do you remember them? A white couch. All the things you can't have after you have kids. Or for that matter, a dog. Just a thought.
So the reason why we can't have nice things is because we don't have secret rooms big enough to keep them in? Okay, sure, why not? Next, it's on to covering alien visitations because, sure, why not?
Now, onto the topic of aliens and American cover-up. Stories in the paper today covering the Wall Street Journal's myth-busting investigation into Washington's alleged hidden research into aliens. And this has completely thrown me because I thought we were getting closer to the big reveal, you know, that they were going to come clean and tell us about the aliens. But apparently the top line here is that the investigation found no evidence of extraterrestrial beings or crafts, but it did find some different sort of cover-ups. It turns out that the US military were sort of double bluffing. Take, for example, Area 51, we would have known from all the movies and documentaries. The paper reports that a US Air Force colonel was sent into a bar near Area 51 out in the desert with some pictures of what looked like a flying saucer hovering nearby. The owners ran with it, stuck the pictures to the wall, and so Area 51 became legend. However, that colonel has now retired and admitted that the pictures were doctored and it was all to hide the testing of a new top secret aircraft that would be tested in the area. So it was safer for locals to assume E.T. than USA. The investigation poo-poos lots of different alien moments, saying many reported UFO sightings were drones, rockets, birds, or in very rare cases, new experimental space rockets and air systems. So if you feel duped like me, then don't feel too bad, because it also came to light that there was a ritual in the classified Air Force program that really helped fan those conspiratorial flames, even within their own home. It came from a hazing ritual for new commanders, many of whom were never told the truth. They basically, new recruits would be shown a photo of a flying saucer named Yankee Blue, And as part of their introduction briefing, they were told that they would be reverse engineering the alien aircraft and to never mention it again. A memo in 2023 called for this hazing ritual to be stopped. And I find that so disappointing. I have to say, though, a report that says aliens don't exist, now we're telling the truth, has a bang of aliens definitely exist off it. I tell you, if the aliens are more advanced and can fix a housing crisis and build a cheap hospital, I, for one, as Kent Brockman put it, welcome our new insect overlords and can be helpful in rounding up others to toil in their underground sugar caves. And in fairness, if aliens are real, I'd say they took one look at California this week and said, ah, you're grand, thanks.
Are we too alienating for them? I'm so sorry. That's where we ought to stop with the Oliver Callan monologue, as delivered for us this morning by Dermot Whelan. Shearfest 2025, a competitive sheep shearing competition, but you already knew that, took place recently in Mount Bellew in Galway, and Today with Claire Byrne reporter Maura Fay was there.
Competitive sheep shearing is a high-speed, high-stakes sport where shearers compete to take off a fleece in record time, all while keeping the sheep calm and the wool in one clean piece. I spoke to a stalwart of the Irish sheep shearing scene, George Graham. He has done sheep shearing in all 32 counties in Ireland, has also travelled abroad to 13 different countries to do it. He explained to me how the competition works.
But it's about skill. You've done a lot of training. It starts off in the lower grades, builds itself up junior, intermediate, senior and open. It's a skill of actually when you're shearing the sheep, of taking the wool all cleanly, not cutting the staple of the wool in the middle, which totally devalues the wool. And then when you're finished shearing the sheep, it's a finished job by having a clean, finished sheep with no bits of wool or no ridges of wool left on. It's not necessarily the fastest competitor will be deemed the winner.
How is it judged?
It's judged on the board when you're shearing, that you cut each staple of wool off cleanly, that you're not second cutting the wool in the middle. That's very important, that you take out the sheep properly. And it's judged then out the back. The finished sheep is judged for no wool left on, no ridges left on, or no damage done to the sheep whatsoever. And I suppose it's very important at all times, whether we're shearing a sheep, doing a demo, shearing on the farm or in competition, our number one priority is to look after the welfare of the animal at all times.
So the judges are looking for a sheep with a perfect face, let's say.
Just like that. Now we're timed as well, but time is one part of it. So it's three parts. It's judging on the board, judging out the back, and time as well. So it's a combination of all three. And as a hands up, it's the competitor with the lowest score will either get through to a final or win the competition.
And when you say on the board, you're saying when the sheep and the competitor are out in front on stage, in front of the audience.
Yeah, taking the wool off the sheep, what you can see. Yeah, that's the part you can see. But you don't see out the back where they're judging out the back, because that's done just out the back where we actually can't see it. But that's another very, very important part of it.
So this is a bit of a tongue twister, but how many sheep can a sheep shearer shear in one day?
Well, I've done records. My highest tally is 504 sheep in a 9-hour day. The current world record for shearing adult sheep in 9 hours is 731 ewes. There has been over 900 lambs shorn in a 9-hour day. So you're not just talking about sheep shearers or whatever, it's actually super athletes. And doing a record like that is much harder than doing two full marathons back to back.
Right, so that's what George reckons. It's much harder than doing the two marathons. How do the sheep react, Maura, going through that shearing process?
That's something I spoke to Tom Dunn about. He's the chairman of the Irish Sheep Shearing Association. I asked him if it was stressful for the sheep having their wool shorn.
No, sheep have to be sheared every year, like regardlessly. They have to get the wool off them, and these are professionals. They're all trained and they know how to handle sheep well. So.
And what type of sheep are being shorn here today?
There's a lot of Galways, mules, and crossbred sheep as well. So.
And are different types of sheep easier to shear?
No, it all depends. A lot depends on the weather too. You know, if the weather is warm and wet for a couple of days, the grease rises in the wool and it leaves it a lot easier for the competitors to get off or all shearers to get off.
And why do sheep need their fleece removed? Why do you have to do this to them?
There's a couple of reasons. Like, fly strike is a reason that, you know what I mean, that they don't get, you know, maggot flies or anything land on them. them and can get down and eat them. Another thing is, if they kept growing the wool over the year, when it gets too big on them, and they end up going on their back, and they wouldn't be able to get off their back, and they could lose, you know what I mean? So it have to be done.
And when fly strike, just explain that to me, like flies lay
eggs on them, lays eggs on them, and they turn into, don't sound rude, but maggots, you know what I mean? And then that's what.
Yeah, it can cause them a lot of health problems.
Yeah, a lot of health problems, yeah, so it has to be done.
You don't want the flies and you don't want the maggots. That's Tom Dunn. You spoke to some of the competitors then as well, Maura.
Yes, there was 110 competitors taking part in the various competitions. The first person I spoke to was Carl Devaney. He farms sheep on the side of Benbulbin in Sligo. He also runs a YouTube channel on sheep farming called YouTube. That's E-W-E-Tube.
YouTube.
Yeah, depending where you're from, Claire, or depending where you're from. So both he and his sister, Joanne, compete in sheep shearing and were in the Connacht final. I spoke to him after the competition and asked him how it went.
Don't know how it went yet. I don't think it went too bad. But it'll be tight. Like, there's good shears even in Connacht. There's a couple of good Mayo shears, a couple of good Galway shears, and then my own sister as well from Sligo. We're both from Sligo, so it's pretty competitive there too. So the prize given will be in an hour or 2 hours, and we'll see how it goes.
Who's the better shearer, you or your sister?
It's tight enough. It's on the day, really. She beats me some days. Some days I beat her, you know. So there's a bit of variability. Sometimes I prefer certain sheep more to her, and then if the time of year, then my sister Joanne also works in Chagas, and maybe she's not doing just as much shearing as she used to now, so maybe she'd be a little bit slower getting into her, whereas I've been flat out because I'm full time in the good weather, so I've a bit more practice on her. But she's very good though. Yeah, very clean.
And explain to me that you prefer a different type of sheep. Like, what type of sheep do you prefer?
Well, generally they'd be good shearing ones that are in good condition. That's what you like. But then there's different breeds as well, and they shear different, and you have different gear for them. Like, so for example, a mule, which is a blue Leicester, I don't want to try and get too technical for you, but like their ones were very lovely open wool. And then maybe Suffolks or Charlies, some of them kind of continental breeds, they can have a little bit tighter wool. But if they're in good condition, they'll shear good too. But you need slightly different gear for them. Like, there's pretty precise the engineering involved in getting the wool off a sheep.
Well, it's an everyday a school day.
Yeah.
Now, when the results were announced, who did better, dare we ask, Carl or Joanne?
So in the Connacht final, Carl came second and Joanne came fourth. So good performances by them both. Then in the national competitions, it was a Kerry man, Dennis O'Sullivan from Bonan outside Kenmare, who won the national machine title. I asked him how he got into the sport.
Just a family thing, I guess. My parents used to go to competitions and that, and kind of just followed on from there and got into it a wee bit. Yep. So just carried on from there and started travelling and shearing. Travelled with my wife Katie and went to New Zealand and competed over there and that. So yeah, kind of got a good foothold on things then.
And what's the scene like in New Zealand in competitive sheep shearing?
Oh, it's very high standard. Very high standard in New Zealand. You've some of the best shearers that are putting out serious numbers every day at a massive standard. So it's the place to go for European people to really stretch their abilities, push them to be faster, to be cleaner, to be more competitive, and just to get up there. Yeah.
What's the toughest part of sheep shearing?
Oh, probably the soreness when you're younger and just the fatigue. I think. My place in life now, I think just being away from my wife and kid, it's quite difficult. You have to do a lot of travelling, so there's a lot of sacrifice. Need to go to shows, need to go to work, to different places to follow the sheep as such. So you need to be away, you can't be at home all the time. So yeah, it's a bit different, so yeah, tough.
And do you ever get kicked by a sheep? Is that sore?
Depends on where they kick you, eh? sometimes it can be a bit sore in that, yeah. It's like any job, it has its sore spots, I suppose, yeah.
Winner of the National Machine title, whatever that means, Dennis O'Sullivan there from Maura Fey's report on Shearfest 2025 on This Morning's Today with Claire Byrne. Fiona has been on quite a quest, as she explained to Katie Hannan on this afternoon's Liveline.
My mother was born in the Rotunda in Dublin in 1935 to Irish parents. And They moved over to London when she was about 12 years old after the war. And although obviously I had an Irish mother, I was quite surprised when I did a general DNA test to find out that my DNA was mostly Irish. And I was absolutely delighted. So I was in my mid-50s when I found this out, and I thought it would be a lovely idea as we're planning a trip around. I booked a trip around Ireland for my husband's 60th birthday, and I thought it'd be a lovely idea to get an Irish passport. And not so much about getting the passport, but what it actually means to me.
Yeah, because you came to Ireland a lot as a child, didn't you?
That's right. Yes. Well, in my early teens, I came over for the first time for a wedding, and I just had the best time with my cousins. And I travelled over a few more times as a teen, and then through my life, I have been backwards and forwards since then too. And I love it, absolutely love it. But I live in England, in the southwest now, and going back 2 years ago in 2023, it was wonderful. But when I found out about the DNA results, I did a lot more digging into our family heritage and past, and was able to go back to the 1820s. I discovered that my great-grandparents and my great-great-grandparents were buried in Glasnevin Cemetery, so we were able to go and visit my grandmother's home that she lived in 1920s, and yeah, I just felt really connected. My grandparents were married in St. Columba's Church on Iona Road in Dublin, and I was actually named Fiona after the road in Dublin. So they were just sort of, it was just really lovely just to reconnect slightly.
Yeah, and you found out something really interesting about your grandfather as well.
Yes, that's right. My granddad, as a baby, he was a year old and travelled with his mother, who was sadly widowed. At a year old, they travelled to New York, and I've got details of them travelling on the Adriatic in 1915, and they had a passage booked on the Lusitania, and thankfully they missed it, because in May 1915 it was torpedoed.
Of course. They missed the boat, but in a very positive way.
Absolutely. And my grandfather was an absolute stickler for timekeeping, which is kind of ironic, but he wouldn't have had any say so as he was only a year old. So
So you might never have been here at all if they had made that deadline.
Absolutely.
Okay, so bring us up to date then. You decided to pursue this idea to get yourself an Irish passport. So you needed to you needed to establish that your mother was Irish, was born here.
Yes, so I started to try to look for her birth certificate down the usual route. Just kept coming up against the brick wall. So I then contacted the Department of Social Protection, and they sent back an entry form which had details of my mother's birth, my grandparents, where she was born, but there was no forename, there was just a dash. So all the details were there, but the forename was missing, and that's been the problem. So I was then told to contact.
I'll stop you there, Fiona. So was this a birth cert?
Yes.
So your mother's birth cert that was supplied to you by the department here doesn't have her name on it.
No.
And the box where your name is normally, it was just
has a dash.
A dash. That is extraordinary.
Well, that's what I was really surprised, and just had no idea how difficult it was going to be then to prove that my mother was even born in Ireland. So.
Oh, okay. So you this year? What year was her? She was born in what year?
In 1935.
Okay, so you know that, and she was born in the Rotunda Hospital.
Yes.
And what was her name?
Her name was Margaret Mary McDermott.
Margaret Mary McDermott, born 1935. What is the actual full date of birth, Fiona?
It's the 17th of December, 1935. And I have her parents' marriage certificate. They were born on the they were married on the 28th of February at St. Columba's Church. So she came along quite quickly, but she came along over nine and a half months after the marriage.
Okay, so no scandal.
No scandal. I thought that maybe that might have been the case, but no, they were. I've got all the legal documentation from my family, going back years, marriage certificate and birth certificate, but just that missing forename. So there's nothing to link me to my mother, and my mother's certificate is sort of hanging somewhere, just incomplete.
That's a frustrated Fiona talking to Katie Hannan on this afternoon's Liveline about trying to apply for an Irish passport. Meanwhile, back on Oliver Callan, Dermot Whelan was joined in studio by virtuoso musician Kate Hearn, who plays both the cello and the recorder, although presumably not at the same time, and lives in the Arctic Circle. She's in Ireland to perform at the West Cork Chamber Music Festival. So, Dermot wanted to know, why recorder as well as cello?
It's quite unusual, but I think back in Baroque times, I love Baroque music, which is why I got into the kind of that period of music.
Yeah.
Recorder players would often have played another instrument, whether it was violin or cello or oboe. So it would have been back then quite rare to only be a recorder player.
Mm.
So, and I really wanted to be a recorder player. And then it just kind of along the way, I was having cello lessons all along and in the youth orchestra and everything. And then when I went to study in Sweden, I was offered a place on both instruments for my master's. So then it just felt, and it's been brilliant career-wise and everything.
Yeah, high achiever. You've doubled your opportunities.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've got to be honest with you, the recorder doesn't hold a huge amount of happy memories for me. I think every parent who's been to a recital is like wincing with the prospect of listening to the recorder. But you play it the way that it was meant to be played rather than 30 school kids banging out a Christ on
alone,
Shield.
May I say.
Yeah, well, look, can we have a little listen, actually, to you playing the recorder, and this is what you sound like. In a quartet. It's beautiful. It does have that sort of medieval feel to it,
yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
I feel like tearing the leg off a cooked chicken and slamming my goblet of wine. that's a few recorders playing there together.
Yes,
it's a beautiful instrument when it isn't first class in a national school having a go at it.
I just want to mention, I started the recorder in national school in first class, even senior infants in a class situation. So I was just one of those who never stopped playing.
And it planted the seed.
I don't remember if it sounded bad or good, but we were 30 in the class when I started.
So it did lead, took you on that whole path. So you're playing at orchestras, and then you end up going to Sweden. And I mentioned that it was love that made you stay. Tell us how all that came about.
So I went to Sweden to do my master's at the Royal College of Music in Stockholm. Mainly because of a teacher, Don Laurin, a recorder player. He's, in my book, one of the best in the world. He's really brilliant. And his students kind of come from all over Europe to study with him, even all over the world. And then I was supposed to come home, but the crash happened in Ireland. It was around, would that have been 2005, 6?
Certainly 2008.
By 2008, that's true. And it wasn't the best environment to be coming home as a newly... educated Baroque musician. But I was back playing with the Irish Baroque Orchestra a lot, and I was travelling playing a lot in France and Poland, and then I met my husband.
Yeah.
And he's Swedish, from the north of Sweden, which is how we ended up moving back north.
So take us up. Yeah. Now, what is that conversation like when he goes, fancy spending the rest of your days in darkness?
I think I started crying. He's going to laugh when I say
could you
this.
Not could do what most Irish women do and gently work them back to the Emerald
so,
Isle?
I have to say, he applied for two jobs, one in Dublin and one in Kearney, and he almost got the job in Dublin, and he did get the job in Kearney. So we moved north, and I was very against it for a few weeks. I was like, no, not going. And then I just thought, it was actually my sister, my older sister, who said, but Kate, what an adventure. You know, you'll regret it for the rest of your life if you don't do it. So I took her advice and we packed up and we moved north.
She said, I'll give it a year and see.
Yeah,
see
no, we did. Goes. We said yeah. We'd give it a year or even 3 years. And now it's been 4 years and it's brilliant.
OK, well, take us there. What is life like? How many kilometres, you know, up into it?
I think we're around 200 kilometres north of the Arctic Circle.
So it's Swedish Lapland up there.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I've been to Finnish Lapland, but this is further north again.
No, not necessarily. It? Okay. It's about probably the same. So Rovaniemi in Finland will be a bit further south than us. But
so describe life, though. What would we see if we just got out of the family
on the time
station
of year.
Wagon?
And so, what would we see? We arrived beginning of September, which is just a gorgeous time of year, and the colours and a lot of purple, and the autumn's very short.
Is it hilly, mountainous?
Yes, very mountainous.
Yeah.
So it's officially
lots
like
of
mountainous.
Forests.
Yeah, lots of forests and lots of mountains.
Yeah.
Lots of lakes, thousands and thousands of lakes.
Oh, I love that.
And the forests, especially in the autumn, like you can go berry picking, wild blueberries and the cloudberries, which are like the north of the gold, they're called. So we spend a lot of time berry picking and then we freeze them and eat them through the winter. Keeps us going. A lot of vitamin C.
It's like those shows I watch. I'm obsessed with those shows about trappers up in those kinds of environments.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you got to go out and check the traps, eh?
Yeah.
But
and the
snow. That would be more Alaskan.
The snow arrives sometime in September, late September. Sometimes like it disappears again.
Yeah.
But from mid-October until, you know, the end of April, it's pretty much winter.
So full on snow, snow boots, snow chains on the cars.
So you were talking about mowing the grass.
You know, you don't see it for half
no,
most of
except
the year.
We go out and we have to clear the driveway, you know. So it's like, oh, it snowed, and it's kind of a
okay.
For me, it's not an activity I really love, but you feel great doing it.
So you that's your satisfying parental job.
Yes.
And you're like,
clearing the driveway.
Look at that driveway. Look what I did.
And no gym membership needed. It's physical work, you know.
And tell us about the darkness, though. I think that, I mean, Irish people go a bit lula, you know, generally with our winters.
Yeah.
You know, we're waiting for Paddy's Day when we feel like it's the beginning of the normal. Yeah. What's it like there? How much light do you actually get?
We have about a month. If not a little bit more, when the sun doesn't rise over the horizon. But the Swedes are very good, just like all the Scandinavian countries, at making things very cozy. So we have gorgeous lighting and we have a fireplace. And so somehow I don't notice it. We have this light that they call the blue light during the day. So there would be a number of hours of daylight even when the sun doesn't rise, so it's almost like having sunset for 4 or 5 hours during the day. So it's gorgeous. The skies can be amazing. And then we have the northern lights.
Does it affect your mood?
I haven't noticed it, but then I'm on tour a lot, so I often would get a week further south, and you just kind of if the sun does come out, I'm standing
Really appreciate it, don't you?
You really appreciate it, and it does give you a different outlook on life and survival, and you know why we're here on the planet, you know.
Yeah, well, particularly if you're looking at the northern lights.
Yeah,
I mean, that, describe what that's like. Having glorious access to that every day.
I haven't quite. People say, oh, I must be used to it, but I'm not. Like, my husband laughs at me, so I'm still running outside. We have a little app that tells you when the northern lights are out, and there's kind of cameras that you can see. Yeah, so I'm still running out to you know, gaze up at the sky.
Do you think you'll stay there?
For the near future. So my husband's just got a new job, which hasn't been announced yet, but one of the big cultural venues in Kearney. So we're definitely staying for the foreseeable future. I'm not sure if I want to grow old there. It's very, like I was talking about this the other day, I'm not going to think about it, but we'll have to
In the
see.
Sense that it's not a good place to grow
no,
old?
No, I just, I don't know. When I think about like when I retire, if that is such a thing for a freelance musician, I don't know.
Best luck
we'll see, but we're building up a really nice community of friends.
Cello and recorder virtuoso Kate Hearn talking to Dermot Whelan this morning. And Kate will be performing at the West Cork Chamber Music Festival, which runs from the 27th of June to the 6th of July. The classic film The Goonies is, somehow, 40 years old this year. And this morning, Crossy joined Claire Byrne to talk about The Goonies and other films from the period that we have fond memories of.
It is beautiful, and it's still one of the loveliest movies that
is
you sit
though?
Back.
Oh my
because
God.
I just wonder whether these things really do stand the test of time, or is it just in our little nostalgic minds that we still think they're brilliant, but they're not?
I think because Steven Spielberg's now looking at doing a kind of a newer revamped version of it, I think he has realised there's still something in this. You know, children still want that. And I think, you know, the era we're in now with phones and ChatGPT and all that sort of stuff, The Goonies is nothing like that. It is just magical. You're using your imagination and you're looking at all these guys. Like, I was looking at all the lads and the girls that were in this movie and I was like, I knew a guy like that. I knew a girl like that. And it kind of brought you back because you wanted those type of friends. Okay, you didn't want to go and run away from your family and find a big ship and all that sort of stuff, but you still wanted those imagination and the crack with your friends when you were growing up.
So you didn't cringe when you were watching
no,
it?
No, not one bit whatsoever. If anything, I actually was a bit upset because, you know, we had this and we had these amazing movies and they were always on. Like, do you know what this brought me back to? 6:30 on a Saturday evening, RTE1,
the big movie.
And I was kind of going, The Goonies would have been on that every once in a while. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't have it on tape, you were waiting for it. It sounds really strange.
Well, listen, I base my theory of cringing when you go back on this one? Because this next one was the first film I saw in the cinema, but also my favourite. I thought it was the best thing ever. Probably for about 30 years. And then I watched it back recently and I changed my view. Let's have a listen.
Hurry, Falcor. The nothing's everywhere.
Don't worry. We'll reach the boundaries of Fantasia.
Do you know where they are?
I have no idea.
Then how do we find a human child?
With luck.
Faster, Falcor, faster! We have to hurry!
All right, hang on tight!
I can feel like you're flying in the studio right now with this, yeah?
Well, you see, that's the never-ending story, right? And when you see it on the big screen, you haven't seen anything ever on the big screen before. It was magical in 1984. But what I did was, because it's available now to stream, and I sat my children down. And I said, come on, we're all going to watch this film. And you should have seen their faces. They were like, what? Can we go now? It was like 20 minutes in. Have we seen
enough?
And did
your heart break kind of
halfway through
it? Not
really, because I sat there with them watching it going, okay, this is really, really bad. Like that flying creature, it looked like someone was holding a teddy up against a green screen and he was on the back of it. Like it was really shocking.
So I think the thing with The Goonies is it didn't really have that sort of magical stuff. So most of the shots were action shots where I think, you were kind of using your imagination a tiny bit more. I was kind of looking into why do we have such grawl? Why do we have such love for all these movies?
Yeah.
And they were saying it's because it was a simpler time. Like most of us were growing up. We went out, you know, with school holidays coming up. We went out and kicked a ball. We played rounders. We, you know, hopped gardens, did whatever. They were all simpler things. Whereas now kids have their phones, so they don't have that. And they don't have those connections with the movies of the present age now.
Yeah. Do you not think, though, that children growing up now will have films that are special to them in this moment and that they'll feel the same way about them when they're our age?
I don't know, because if you break it into the 90s then, all right, you look at Home Alone. Again, it was about that difficult time in a kid's life where they're a kid, they're not a kid and they're not an adult. Mm-hmm. They're a teenager. There's a tad bit of devilment in them and they want to go exploring. Do kids go exploring now? Are they allowed to go exploring? Are they allowed to go away, run through fields, build tree huts, all that sort of stuff?
Yeah,
and
maybe
I think
not as
that's
much.
Why. And actually, a mad thing that I heard about The Goonies was it was all shot scene after scene because Spielberg wanted the cast to know what was going on in each scene, whereas instead of, you know, in most movies
you're back and forth and,
and that's why every little bit when you're looking at their little faces and they're running around the place. I'm sorry, I think I was Chunk. He loved food. I love food. I had a friend of mine who was Matt. You know, he was always the mouth. He is mouth in the movie. And I think that's what we all relate to, is all those little things.
Well, another one that did work when I showed it at home recently was this one. Let's have a listen.
E.T. Home phone.
phone home. E.T. phone home. E.T. phone home.
Yeah, it's still really good. Still works.
When you hear that E.T. phone home, there's something inside you that makes you want to cry.
Yeah.
It was just so beautiful. And I'm so happy that nothing, you know, they haven't tried to remake that again, or they haven't tried to, you know, turn it into 2025. And I know there was ads and all that sort of stuff that E.T. appeared in, but I think that movie should just stay there for the rest of its life.
Yeah, and my guys love it because the start of it's quite scary. You know, it's in the dark and he's hanging around in the shed. And no one really knows. And then you have the FBI or whoever those guys are, CIA, out searching in the dark across the fields for him with their torches. So it's a little bit scary.
It's very scary.
And then you have the emotion and the,
Drew Barrymore. Mm-hmm. Like, it's mad when you think, you know, massive TV show now, massive career.
Yeah, it was 1982. Like, it is ancient, that film. Still as good now as it was then. Now, next up, we have the coming of age classic. This is Stand By Me. Will we have a listen?
Yeah, let's have a listen to this.
We headed home, and although many thoughts raced through our minds, we barely spoke. We walked through the night and made it back to Castle Rock a little past 5 o'clock on Sunday morning, the day before Labor Day. We'd only been gone 2 days, but somehow the town seemed different, smaller.
I've never watched this, and I've never watched My Girl because I considered them both to be too sad.
This movie stuck with me for an age afterwards. It was a couple of friends. I know where we live in Avon, there was a railway track that was never used beside us, and we had been on that railway track all the time. And one of the lads got a lend of this movie. I remember watching it. So basically, the kids are going to look for a kid, a dead body. Mm-hmm. So they're gone looking for this teenager who had passed. And it is just so frightful because when they're going on this walk, you know, you're getting stories about them, emotional stories that probably, you know, when you were a teenager, you started feeling these things, whether you were left out, whether you were being bullied or whatever it was. And this one killed me.
Crossy talking about the great Stand By Me and other movies from the 80s with Claire Byrne this morning as The Goonies turns incredibly 40 this year. We all know the tune. But do we know who it was written for? No, not Billy Murphy. Someone else entirely, but still someone from Cork, obviously. The Frankenwalters frontman Paul Linehan spoke to Ray Darcy this afternoon about the origins of the band's most famous tune.
What a brilliant song. And now it's even more brilliant that I've heard this story. So he had all that attention, and I suppose people were using the word on the cusp, and you could see your music career mapped out in front of you. Was that the way it was?
At that time?
Yes. Yeah.
It was like we'd moved to London in 1992, and we kind of just kept building and building, you know, our fan base, and, you know, the press was kind of, you know, writing about us more and more. And then we released a few singles, and then they all started, you know. I think the one before that got into, like, that way, the Happy Busman got in for 43 in the charts, and then This Is Not a Song got in at like 41 or something. Song, and then eventually, after all, just went in at number 11.
Yeah. And as a result, you were gigging around the place in the UK.
Oh, yeah. Well, we had been playing gigs in the UK previous to that as well. We'd done all our work was done before, after all. I mean, we gigged from 91 to 93, for a few years, just kind of constantly gigging. Okay. Up and down England, and mainly, I suppose.
So talk
we
to,
did Ireland as well.
Talk to us about the gig then in Newcastle. That's where it was, wasn't it?
Oh, where we met. Yeah.
Yeah.
We were supporting a band called the Blue Aeroplanes. I don't know if anyone
never
has
heard of them. No.
But they're a good band, actually. Yeah. And I remember just after the show, Katie caught my eye, and she was working in the venue as the graphic designer. And I just started chatting to her, and then I kind of I just just she was way out of my league, but I just gave it a go and I just asked her on a date. So because she said she was going to London with her friend the following week, so I basically we had a date then down in London, and then just it all kind of blossomed from there. Then
yeah. Well, you were a bit of a lost soul. Even the words of the song, "When I'm far from home and lonely,"
yeah.
And you were. You know that people don't think about that when they're thinking about the rock and roll lifestyle. But you were away from home, and you by your own admission, you were an immature 26-year-old.
Yeah, I would have been definitely. You see, the thing is, I mean, I did get homesick, and like. I wouldn't get homesick, no, but I was then, and I was immature, and yeah. Like that's how kind of the relationship kind of ended between myself and Katie. At the time, I was living in London, and the rest of the band, they moved back to Ireland, and I think we were just having a couple of arguments, and I just decided, you know, I wasn't going to tough it out. Yeah. So I just decided, you know, Ayrshire, I'm homesick. So I went home. So that was how I think that was my immaturity at the time.
Yes. And at what stage then did you write After All?
Well, After All was written before that. Hmm. After All was written, I mean, we split in, I think it was around 94. After All was written in 92. Hmm. And I think I had an argument on the phone with Katie about something stupid, and I just came home and I was a bit upset, and I was in Ireland, you see, and she was in England, and I just something prompted me to write the song, and it was kind of I was just thinking about how much I'd miss her if she was gone, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, and I think I was taking the relationship we had a bit for granted at the time, and I was kind of just trying to make sense of that, and I was thinking, like, you know, how people, we tend to take, you know, our lives for granted and our love for granted at times, you know. And I decided, you know, the song was just started to writing itself then. And I just think it's kind of about that for me anyway. It's about, you know, realizing what you have and kind of almost celebrating it, you know. And just it was me declaring my undying love as well, you know.
For Katie.
And I was in love at the time.
And did she know that you wrote that song at the time?
Oh yeah, she did. Yeah,
okay.
She did.
So then, fast forward then, and we all love that song, not knowing that Katie existed, and then it got a whole new life after the Young Offenders and the scene on the bus, and after that you thought, well, I wonder what Katie's doing.
Yeah, exactly. I suppose I was overwhelmed by the success of the song again with the Young Offenders. I mean, the song wasn't even released and it got into the, it was number one on the Irish charts.
Yeah.
But at the time, I was so grateful for what Katie had kind of given me the inspiration. And I was just wondering, you know, where she was, because I hadn't seen her in about 25 years or something. And I was just hoping that she was okay somewhere. And I was kind of prompted then. I looked her up on Twitter, and I found someone that kind of looked like her with the same name, and I just put in a request on Twitter, but she didn't come back a couple of years later because she had her Twitter turned off.
Right.
But eventually she came back, and I found out she was living in England, and she had been married with two daughters, and she said that she'd come along to her next London show with her daughters, and she came along, and it was just great to meet up again, you know.
The Frank and Walters, Paul Linehan there, talking to Ray Darcy this afternoon about the origins of the band's most famous song, After All. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, audio artist Mo Hart spoke to Dermot Whelan this morning about her role in making live theatre productions more accessible for people with additional needs.
I know that your work basically is in three parts, and I hope I'm not oversimplifying it, but let's start with the audio description. How does that work?
Okay, so audio description, the traditional way, it provides a verbal description of visual elements in a play, a film, an exhibition, or a museum, or I've actually done stuff for Bloom, so with gardens as well. So that makes it accessible for visually impaired people, low-sighted, blind. But also it can be a support sometimes for neurodivergent people who have issues around reading expressions, body language. So, that's audio description for you.
Yeah, and if you were in a theatre then, would you kind of disappear up into a lighting box or something and then be able to give someone narration throughout the show through headphones or something like that to add an extra layer?
Yes, that's right. So I prepare a script that fits into the tone of the piece and in the pauses of the piece, and I'm upstairs giving a live commentary of what's happening. I'm a whisperer, in their ears. But there is embedded audio description as well that we've been playing with Jodie O'Neill. I worked with her on Grace, which was about a non-verbal young woman, and we had me on the side of the stage, kind of like a narrator or a storyteller.
So it becomes part of the show for the whole audience, as opposed to just a discreet one in somebody's ear. Yeah, that's really interesting. I remember before hearing about visually impaired people going to football matches and how a new piece of tech allowed them to place their hands on a little device. And wherever the ball, there was a little gizmo in the ball. And wherever the ball moved, it would then relay that to a map of the pitch where the football fan could sense where the ball was going. So, and it would vibrate if they got close to the goal. So it kind of created a sense of atmosphere, but through their fingertips. I thought that was fascinating. I mean, would visually impaired people be able to enjoy, say, something like a dance recital that doesn't necessarily have a whole load of dialogue? Is that still something that's accessible?
Yeah, so I recently did something for Lul, who are the inaugural dance company for the whole of Ireland. There was a dance performance called Cora. So we had a sensory tour, touch tour beforehand, which was a great help, I think, in supporting them to have access to the show in terms of, like, for instance, there was one piece where there was a lot of gravity, so I used a ball or the concept of time, so using a clock, fractals, so I brought in a plant and we touched them. And also there's program notes before the show. So you're setting up as much as you can, the lighting, the set, the general way the characters move, their costumes. Often we can go on stage, so we get a sense of the geography of the space. It really is like a warm welcome to people who may not be used to having access to the arts for whatever reason, really. You might just be a nervous first timer. Took me a while to get used to finding my place.
I think
the whole shebang.
I'm sure, but very, very interesting at the same time. I think it can be unusual for maybe people who aren't visually impaired to go, why would you go to a dance recital if you can't see what's happening? But I think, I mean, we listen to sporting events all the time on the radio, and we have someone there to paint us a picture, and we create images of the game in our mind and all that. So I think, you know, our brains and our minds can fill in a lot of the blanks and create a lot of art internally as opposed to externally. Tell me about touch tours.
So touch tours, that's you can touch the props, the costumes, maybe you can walk onto the stage and maybe sit in a chair. I remember working on translations years ago, and one of the low-sighted people was on stage, and they said, oh, just think, we'd be looking out over, is it Donegal that is based in translations? So, they're adding layers to the cultural sort of experience.
So would you bring them
into the
theatre before, when it's empty, before the show, and you let them walk around and touch the props and the costumes and all that?
Yes.
Even the wigs?
Yes, sometimes the artists will come out So we can get a sense of their voice and maybe how they, maybe what brought them to the character, because it's not a straight line access, you know. Sometimes we can't possibly, like you said, with dance, you know, there are questions around that. We can't possibly include them in the whole vision, but we can do other things that give them a leg up to having that experience and be able to discuss it afterwards in the pub over a pint with their loved ones or friends. Add their bit to the cultural conversation, which is really important, isn't it? It makes it a lot more interesting. We have other voices.
Yeah, of course. And you then, the third part of the puzzle are the sensory tours. I guess these are aimed more specifically at neurodivergent patrons. And would these tours look fairly similar to the touch tours, or how would they differ?
They would. They might be calmer. I might bring, I know you're a mindfulness practitioner yourself.
That's right.
I might bring in, I'm a mindfulness teacher as well. So I like to call it heartfulness, because that's what it really is, isn't it?
Mm.
It's like getting us into our bodies.
Nicely put.
So, yeah, I might bring some of that in. I might bring some of my somatic practice, be really permission giving around moving in different ways, sounding in different ways, possibly even being a little bit playful with that. And, you know, really deeply listening and maybe not so many words, which is where I'm really comfortable.
Yeah.
Audio artist Mo Hart talking about making theatre more accessible for people with additional needs with Dermot Whelan this morning. And that's all I have for you on this Parental Guidance edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Shurathon. Don't forget, you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. And the mothership, that'd be Playback, is on the air and in podcast land every Saturday with an altogether good, better, best look back at an entire week in radio. But for me, until the next time, thank you for listening and good luck.
In the name of the fertilizer, the lawn, and the holy strimmer. Amen.